to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In this week's show, we'll be looking at political party conflict during the American Civil War. Talking History's Jim Madison will be speaking with Mark Neely, the author of The Union Divided. And after that, Ted Steinberg will join us to talk about the importance of the environment in history. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on November 10, 1775, the Continental Congress passed a resolution drafted by John Adams to raise 2 battalions of Marines to augment the Continental Navy. The adoption of the resolution created the Continental Marines, later to be known as the United States Marine Corps. Used as landing forces, the newly formed Continental Marines proved to be invaluable in several engagements during the Revolutionary War. In March 1776, for example, a detachment of Marines commanded by Captain Samuel Nicholas, the Corps' first commissioned officer, seized New Province Island in the British Bahamas. The disbandment of the Continental Navy in 1783, following American independence, led to a 15-year hiatus for the Continental Marines. It was not until the threat of war at sea with France in 1798 that Congress established the U.S. Navy. And on July 11, 1798, John Adams, once again this time as president, signed the bill formalizing the permanent establishment of the U.S. Marine Corps.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, thanks to Hollywood's Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Ark of the Covenant is one of the most famous objects in the Bible. The biblical ark was the wooden box containing the 2 tablets of the 10 commandments given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. King Solomon placed it in the temple in the Israelite capital of Jerusalem, where it remained until the 6th century B.C., and then it vanished, lost or perhaps destroyed when the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem in 587 B.C., if not earlier. There are several scenarios as to what happened to the ark. The Hollywood version has it sitting in a U.S. government warehouse. Some think ancient Israelites hid it under the temple when the Babylonians invaded. Others say the Babylonians stole or destroyed it. And the amateur archaeologist Ron Wyatt, who has since died, said he rediscovered the ark under the hill where Christ was crucified. There is no evidence for any of these theories. Then there's the Ethiopian scenario recently in the news. The Bible says that the Queen of Sheba visited King Solomon. Most scholars believe she came from present-day Yemen. But Ethiopian legend maintains that she was from that country and that she gave birth to Solomon's son, Menelik. According to legend, Menelik visited Solomon, and during his visit, his aides stole the ark and brought it back to Ethiopia, where it remains in St. Mary of Zion Chapel, never seen by anyone but its guardian. Raymond Matthew Ray of the American Catholic magazine Crisis recently visited Ethiopia in an attempt to verify this story. He met with the current guardian of the ark, who insisted that the ark was indeed in the chapel, but Ray reports that he was not allowed to see it. So the mystery of the lost ark remains. This is Talking History. Much has been written on American politics before the Civil War, many historians arguing that bungled politics actually precipitated the conflict. Less has been done with politics after secession, how disunion affected political parties, political contests, and the conduct of the war itself. Talking History's Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University, takes on that subject with Mark Neely, the author of a recent book on politics during the Civil War.
Seldom, if ever, have Americans been as divided as during the Civil War, split not just between North and South, but split within the North, between Democrat and Republican. Our guest today is Mark E. Neely, Jr., who is McCabe Greer Professor of History at Pennsylvania State University and the author of a book called The Union Divided, Party Conflict in the Civil War North, published in 2002 by Harvard University Press. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Jim. How are you?
I'm fine. Let's begin by trying to understand this divided Union through looking at an episode that you describe in your book as downright chilling. That is, the threat that came from Union soldiers in the field in January of 1863. Why was this so downright chilling? What was it, first of all, and why was it so chilling?
Well, after the elections in November of 1862, the Democratic Party made surprising gains, including gaining control of the legislatures in Indiana and Illinois. And when, after the new year came and the new Democrats took their seats and began showing genuine opposition, the soldiers in the field from Illinois and to some degree Indiana were, you know, sitting in their snug winter quarters. This was a war when it was difficult to fight out of season, and Civil War soldiers tended to go into winter quarters. These are citizen soldiers. They're getting newspapers from home, and they're sitting in their log huts reading, and they read about the rise of this partisan opposition in the legislatures in their home states, and they are shocked by it.
And, Mark, it's an opposition that is questioning the war. Is that correct, questioning the direction of the war?
Well, yes, right.
What upsets them about it?
The opposition, one of the things you need to understand about the idea of an opposition party in the 19th century is that the style of politics is a style that we're not used to. I call it brinksmanship. The politicians had extreme partisan loyalty, and when they were in opposition, they opposed with a vehemence. And so the noises that the soldiers are hearing from the Democratic opposition sound like truce and peace and things that sound like they want to end the war effort. So various regiments, I think I counted 63 Illinois regiments and batteries eventually over a period from January to May, drafted political resolutions denouncing the rise of partisan activity in their state legislatures. And what's chilling about them is that the soldiers basically say, we've put aside partisanship. The only party we're for now is the Union. We don't like to see this. We think everybody should put the party platforms aside for the war. This looks like treason to us. And if we get an order from Governor Richard Yates of Illinois or from President Lincoln, we could go to Springfield and disperse this scum. They use very strong language.
And they're threatening physical force against political opposition. Is that correct?
That's right.
And that's what's downright chilling, I suppose.
Yes, and I, frankly, when I first read these, the first two sets of resolutions, I saw were sent to Abraham Lincoln. And when I first saw them, I was surprised. I had never really seen anything like it in all of United States history, to see military units sending in such resolutions. And in a way, that sparked the book. The common wisdom among historians was that since there were political parties survived in the North and the Confederacy didn't have them, that having political parties in the North and party conflict as usual during the war, that this actually was a sort of advantage to the North and a disadvantage to the Confederacy.
Why would having two political parties actively engaging in politics, partisan politics, be an advantage to the North?
Well, that's what I asked in the end.
I mean, that's not your argument. That's an argument you're challenging, correct?
That's right. I'm challenging that argument. And I must say that I had trouble understanding it when I saw activity like this. But we know the advantages of political parties. For one thing, they famously make extremism difficult. They moderate extremes. You can't get out if you're a member of the political party and just say, take any position you want to. You've got to go through committees. You've got to satisfy a lot of people. And in general, the common wisdom is that they moderate extremes. But I looked at the partisan activity in the Civil War North, and I thought, I do not see the extremes being moderated. Something else must be the secret of the political advantage of the North during the Civil War.
Yes. And again, these soldiers' resolutions in early 1863 are anything but moderation.
That's right. Yes. They're quite extreme. And as I say, some of them threaten physical force against the legislatures in the states, in Illinois and Indiana.
Now, there's another assumption, I think, certainly at this time in American history, that in a time of crisis, when a nation goes to war, politics stops, parties go out of business, everyone rallies around the flag and supports the nation. That's not the case in this war, is it?
No, it isn't, and it can't be, because the United States has a constitutional government. And as the historian Roy Nichols pointed out a long time ago, you know, we get, in a parliamentary system, you have elections when you need them, and in the United States, you get them by the clock, whether you need them or not. And furthermore, in the Civil War era, the elections weren't, again, Roy Franklin Nichols pointed this out, weren't nearly so standardized as the elections we're used to. We get them in neat two-year clumps, you know, the presidential election year, the off-year congressional elections, presidential elections again. And in between, you know, after we cast our ballot, we tend to kind of mop our foreheads and say, whew, enough of politics for a while. Politics never stopped in the middle of the 19th century because the states set the election times. And in odd years and even, and in most of the months of the year, somewhere there was an election going on. In fact, during the Civil War lasted 48 months. And on average, there was an election every other month of the war. Yeah.
Was there any thought, any argument made to suspend elections? I mean, after all, this may be the most serious crisis the nation has ever faced. Would there not be a legitimate argument to stop having elections?
You know, there really was. I found almost no instance of anyone suggesting that elections be postponed in the North. People in the United States had internalized the Constitution. And once the elections came, the clock was inexorable. What they hadn't internalized was the way that elections were fought in the 19th century, and that is by political parties. Although most Americans had very few reservations about the Constitution, in fact, cherished and worshipped it, many of them had reservations about political parties, and especially, as you pointed out, about continuing party conflict in wartime. So even Abraham Lincoln thought that political parties were normal in times of peace. But in times of common danger, not so clear. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move to the Democrats. They really have the hard chore, don't they? Being the loyal opposition or the opposition in time of war is the worst position for a party, isn't it?
Well, it's particularly difficult in this war because of the peculiarity of timing. And it's a very difficult position in the United States in general. The Civil War, as we know, begins with the beginning of a new presidential administration, almost, it's like 1 month after Abraham Lincoln has inaugurated, the Civil War begins, a little over a month. And so a Civil War coincides almost exactly with a presidential term. And the Constitution gives the president a four-year term and also makes the president commander-in-chief. So what the opposition party faces in such a situation is a president loaded up with the war powers for four solid years and very little prospect of making a dent in that. The Democrats, as it turned out, were very weak in Congress anyway and in the states. And besides that, the United States has not only a written constitution, but like other places, an unwritten one. And the unwritten constitution made their role even tougher because every politician in the Congress during the Civil War remembered his American history and knew that the party which had opposed the War of 1812, the Federalists back in the War of 1812, that their strident opposition to the war, which included unwillingness to vote supplies for the soldiers in the field and unwillingness to allow militias to leave the state to fight out of state, things like that, that extreme opposition to the War of 1812 after the Battle of New Orleans and the peace treaty killed the Federalist Party. And so politicians have a sense that if they don't vote supplies for the soldiers in the field, it's going to kill their party. Mm-hmm. So between that and the real constitutional powers that the commander-in-chief has for four solid years, the role of the Democratic opposition was very frustrating indeed.
Right. Now, if America had had a parliamentary system, you suggest this would have been quite a different story.
If America had had a parliamentary system, the Lincoln administration would have lasted, I think, maybe as little as 5 months, and certainly no longer than 17. In other words, after the shocking defeat at the Battle of Bull Run in July of 1861, when federal soldiers fled the field, officer and an enlisted man alike, and came back dripping wet from a drenching rain, pathetically trailed into Washington. after expectations of victory on the part of the North, that this shock would have brought down, I think, a parliamentary government. There had been a vote of no confidence in the Lincoln administration, and he would have been a 5 months prime minister. And if that didn't bring down the Lincoln administration, certainly the defeat of George McClellan's great army on the peninsula before Richmond at the end of June 1862, which brought on national trauma, that would have ended the Lincoln administration. And so what accounts in large part for the success of what politically accounts for the success of the North is the ability of the Lincoln administration to stay the course, and it's the Constitution that lets them do that.
Yes, and your book does indeed celebrate the Constitution in this context and many others as well.
Yeah, and at points I think maybe it verges on constitutional determinism. I'm not sure I believe that, but looking at this, I thought that it was misplaced in the case of the Civil War to attribute the success of the North to the political parties, and that those accolades really belong to the United States Constitution.
Yes. I have to ask just one final question, Mark Neely. What is it about the Civil War that has so obviously enthralled you for all these years and all these wonderful books you've written?
Well, there are several things I think that have kept me interested in the Civil War over 30 years, and I'm more aware of them now. It used to be I just enjoyed them, and now I think I have some awareness of what it is I enjoy about them. But first off, I like the reliability of the sources. There's no telephone. And the sources are written down in handwriting, on paper, by the people who are responsible for them. They're very reliable. I also like it because it's a pre-bureaucratic age, and I don't have to deal with the expertise and language of technocrats. And as the historian Paul Fussell has pointed out, it's also an age before deliberate propaganda and advertising, and so language is very reliable and trustworthy. I like that. And
you like reading Abraham Lincoln's own words in his own handwriting.
That's
right. Respect.
Exactly. And the other people of the era. And finally, of course, what I like about it is that, as we have seen today, I think, it was an era really quite different from ours and somewhat mysterious. And trying to understand, as I have attempted to in this book, the ways that political parties were different and the different ways that their roles were perceived then from now, that has proved to me endlessly fascinating.
Yes. Are you a military historian as well as a political historian?
Yeah, I do. So I have written military history as well as political and constitutional, some intellectual history as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Well, thank you very much, Mark Neely.
Thank you.
Our guest today has been Mark E. Neely, Jr. of Pennsylvania State University, the author of a new book, The Union Divided, Party Conflict in the Civil War North.
For our site of the week, we've selected two sites associated with the best-known political figure of the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln. Here to tell you about one of those sites is Joey Skidmore.
Abraham Lincoln only owned one home in Springfield, Illinois, and today it is a National Historic Site. The house was constructed in 1839 as a one-and-a-half-story cottage. Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln moved in 1844, 2 years after they married, and stayed there until they left for Washington in 1861, after Abraham was elected President of the United States. The home, which the Lincolns expanded to two full stories, has been restored to its 1860s appearance, revealing Lincoln as husband, father, politician, and president-elect. It is situated in the midst of a four-block historical neighborhood, which the National Park Service is restoring so that the neighborhood will appear much as Lincoln would have remembered it.
The other Lincoln National Historic Site, Abraham Lincoln's birthplace, is located in Hodgenville, Kentucky. The future president was born there on Sinking Spring Farm in 1809. In 1894, a New York businessman purchased the farm, as well as a log cabin purported to be the actual house in which Lincoln was born, and took the cabin on tour of the nation. In 1900, a group of people that included Mark Twain, William Jennings Bryan, and Samuel Gompers bought the farm and log cabin and brought them together to form a memorial to the fallen leader. President Theodore Roosevelt laid the cornerstone in 1909, and in 1916 it became a national park. At the time of its purchase, the early history of the log cabin was obscure. Subsequent research suggests, however, that it is almost certainly not Lincoln's log cabin. Site interpreters now refer to it as symbolic of the one in which Lincoln was born.
Oh,
finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. History is almost always seen as the product of people, usually men but increasingly women as well. Ted Steinberg, professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University, insists that nature has had a bit to do with it as well, and in some cases steered the course of history.
For most professional historians, and almost by definition for most Americans, history unfolds against a stable environmental backdrop. Open a U.S. history textbook, and glued inside the cover is the familiar map of the nation, as if the realities of place and nature were simply a given. The natural world, plants and animals, climate and weather, soil and water, is taken for granted and passed over in the rush to discuss what, according to many, really mattered: wars, elections, and the other mainstays of our national past. Those concerned with social history, which is centered on exploring the lives of ordinary people, have proved no more receptive to the idea of nature as a dynamic force. Practicing history from the bottom up meant digging down into the nitty-gritty of everyday existence, into work, family life, sexual orientation, gender relations, and race. But, by and large, the social historians put away their shovels when they reached the land and soil itself. And yet, a shift as important as the Industrial Revolution, for example, did not take place in a setting from which nature was somehow magically excluded. Industrial transformation never would have unfolded in the way that it did were New England not blessed with the ample precipitation and water resources required to power the cotton mills. Water that had to be controlled with dams, which in turn put an end to spring fish runs and ultimately brought factory owners into conflict with distant rural farmers for whom salmon and shad represented their next meal. Even a political and military event like the Civil War was shaped by ecological factors. Soldiers and horses needed to be fed, and for that to happen, both the Union and Confederacy had to turn to the land. Robert E. Lee may have been a brilliant military strategist, but between battles, he was reduced to finding ample forage for the horses his troops depended on to fight. Likewise, the growth of modern, auto-centered suburbs hardly liberated people from nature. Natural forces impinged on suburban life, at times dramatically, as homeowners confronted landslides, floods, fires, and outbreaks of insects and weeds. Nature was not nearly as passive and unchanging as historians may have led us to believe. Writing history from the ground up means acknowledging the unpredictable outcomes involved in incorporating nature into human designs. As Karl Marx once wrote, people make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. Marx called our attention to the imposing social and economic forces that people have had to confront. But ecological factors, as formidable as the ones Marx had in mind, have also shaped how the American past has unfolded, at times upsetting even the best laid plans. When it comes to the human control of nature, beware. Things rarely turn out the way they are supposed to. The wind shifts, the earth moves, and, now and again, when you least expect it, a flock of birds swoops in for a meal.
You've been listening to Ted Steinberg, professor of history and law at Case Western Reserve University and the author of Down to Earth, Nature's Role in American History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.